would have company, so he was completely wrong-footed when a man opened the door. So much so that it took him a moment or two to realize that Rachel's visitor was none other than Charlie Jones.
"Well, well, well," he said, pulling out his warrant card and pushing it under Charlie's nose, as if Charlie didn't know exactly who he was already. "It's not often we get to kill two birds with one stone."
The fact that Rachel Porter was sitting up in bed, half-dressed, and Jones was looking decidedly shifty, told him that whatever had been happening in that room wasn't something that they would want to share. For some strange reason, the sight of her like that, disheveled, half-naked, irked him more than it should.
"I don't believe in coincidences, Mr. Jones. Perhaps you'd like to tell me why you're here."
Charlie patiently explained that he had bumped into Rachel that morning, that she had had another fit, and that he had helped her get back to the hotel. It was as simple as that. Ratcliffe wasn't buying it. He glanced at Rachel, sitting up in bed, her eyes wide as if she was auditioning for the part of Bambi.
"Really? As simple as that? I didn't have you down as the Good Samaritan type, Mr. Jones," he said, his gaze settling once again on the woman in the bed.
The fact that Rachel's mouth was swollen bothered him, but he wasn't there to talk about that.
"We've been to see your sister, Rachel. She's not well, not at all."
If he expected a torrent of concern to flow from Rachel's mouth, he would have been disappointed. Her reaction was to ask what was wrong, nod her head, and reassure him that Frances would no doubt survive the ordeal.
"Frances is tough," Rachel said sagely.
What was it with these people? Ratcliffe leaned on the edge of the dressing table opposite the bed, forcing Rachel to edge away from him and pull the covers up to her chin.
"Rachel, I need to ask you some questions about Stella, but as you are currently indisposed, perhaps you'd like me to give you a few minutes to get dressed?"
"If you wouldn't mind," she said with a blush and a look that encompassed Charlie too. Ratcliffe hadn't forgotten him. He was just biding his time to see what would come out of this bizarre situation. Both men stepped outside the room and Ratcliffe heard the lock on the door click into place in their wake. Rachel was taking no chances and he couldn't blame her.
"I should go," Charlie said, discomfort rolling off him in waves, judging by the way his jaw was twitching, and the fact that he was clenching and unclenching his hands.
Ratcliffe was curious. It came across as a big reaction for a Good Samaritan.
"Might as well stay. I'd like to talk to you too, so no reason we can't kill two birds with one stone. For now."
Charlie stared at him, tension locking his features into a mask of what looked like impatience.
"Whatever," he said.
Ratcliffe put his hand up in a gesture of peace. "It's just a chat, nothing formal. Not yet. I wouldn't be here on my own if that was the case." His words didn't do anything to alter the other man's demeanor. Ratcliffe heard the lock click back. Rachel was dressed and standing pensive, but with the door wide open.
"Tell me about Stella. What's she like?"
Rachel looked from Ratcliffe to Charlie, taking her time in constructing a suitable answer.
"Stella is quiet, nondescript and timid, really. She cared for my mother after her stroke, which wasn't an easy task. The fact that she's gone surprises me. She loved the Limes. I didn't think she would ever leave. I don't know what to tell you, really. She might have changed. I'm not sure I would know her at all anymore."
"You said, my mother, that's an odd thing to say. What do you mean?" The distinction in her words had sprung out at him. Rachel sighed. "Stella is my half-sister. She's Valerie, my mother's stepchild. Stella's mother died when she was young. Our father married Mother when Stella was 12. She had Frances already, and I came later. The Limes was her birth mother's family home, so Stella always had more of a connection to it than the rest of us, I suppose. I think she felt it was more hers than ours. Our father inherited it when his first wife died, and Mother got it after he went."
"So Frances is a half-sister too?" Ratcliffe asked.
Rachel nodded, her face tense. He guessed that Frances might be a sore subject.
"What happened to your father?"
"I never knew him. He died when I was a baby. We didn't talk about him. Mother wouldn't, and Stella wasn't allowed to. The past was always the past with Mother."
Ratcliffe turned to Charlie. "Do you remember him?"
"Before my time. Never knew him. My mum mentioned him from time to time. She didn't think much of him."
Having met Delia Jones, Ratcliffe wasn't surprised at this. Other than her own son, Delia didn't seem to have a high opinion of anyone. He turned back to Rachel.
"Have you managed to remember anything about where Stella might have gone? Friends or relatives she may have decided to visit?" he asked. Rachel shook her head. There are no relatives and no friends. Stella is a shy person, so she never had friends. Our mother didn't encourage friends, but I've not seen them for a long time. Maybe that changed. Despite his questions, Ratcliffe knew more about the family than he was choosing to let on. Angie had done some homework on them. What about the shop? Didn't Stella work in the family business? Might she have met people there? The Porters had owned a haberdashery, closed for years now, but Stella had worked there. I really don't know. I think the shop closed when our mother got ill. I haven't seen them for so long. I don't know. I'm sorry, but I'm really not much help. He turned to Charlie. What about you, Mr. Jones? You knew her. Where do you think she might have gone? Charlie shrugged. Don't ask me. I haven't set eyes on her for 30 years. Neither did I want to. Sorry, Rach, but you know it's true. Ratcliffe knew it was true, too. The last time Charlie Jones had clapped eyes on Stella Baxter was the day she had given evidence against him in court. He sighed. Why the hell did none of these people know anything? Rachel, do you have a photograph of her? Rachel laughed as if surprised by the request. No. We didn't do photos, unless Francis has one. There are pictures of her wedding, I think. Ratcliffe nodded. Typical. Okay, now, can you tell us anything about the body that you found yesterday? The child. It was the first time that Rachel had shown any real emotion in front of him. Her eyes began to fill with tears as she shook her head. I don't know, I really don't. I didn't even know that there was a cupboard there until yesterday. Oh, my God. I can't believe that someone would do that to a baby, she said, her voice trembling. Ratcliffe noticed Charlie's body stiffen at Rachel's words. People are capable of some terrible things, he said, looking straight at Charlie. Charlie looked away. He asked a few more generic questions and got no further forward. Whatever these two were hiding, he wasn't going to get it out of them in the casual confines of a hotel room. Sooner or later, he'd have to call them both in for a formal interview, put them under a bit more pressure. For now, they'd at least given him a few hints as to which direction those formal interviews would take. In Ratcliffe's mind, nothing was ever wasted. As he drove back to the station, he figured that there was no alternative but to get a picture of Stella and give it to the press as soon as possible. Someone would have seen her recently. All they had to do was pick her up when that someone came forward, and they would. They always did. Whatever had gone on in that house over the years, Stella was the one who would know. Ratcliffe was convinced of it. Strangely, it still bugged him that Charlie had been in Rachel's room. The air between them had been crackling with tension when he had walked in, and whatever their agenda was, it was surely loaded with something more than curiosity. It hadn't taken him long to work out that there was more between Charlie Jones and Rachel Porter than met the eye. Charlie's links to the Porter house went further than his past criminal record. The fact that his mother owned a photograph of a girl who was the spit of Rachel had sparked reckless instincts, and he'd been more than a little smug when the team had turned off a marriage certificate and a birth certificate. Maybe Rachel and Charlie assumed that he already knew that they were married, but neither of them had volunteered it, and there had been no mention of their child. Though Jones had balked when Rachel got upset about the dead baby. If Rachel was telling the truth about having left years before and having no contact, she had left her kid, too. She came across as a nice woman. Shy, worried, but nice. Could a woman who'd left her own child be called nice? It depended on the circumstances, he supposed, but Charlie Jones had been convicted of murder, and quite frankly, Ratcliffe wouldn't have left Delia Jones in charge of his dog. To leave a baby with those two would be a determinedly odd thing to choose. Rachel Porter needled him. She wasn't what she appeared to be, and there was far more to that situation than met the eye. And he was going to find out what it was. Back in the incident room, he picked up a message to call Ferris. News was in on the bodies. All he wanted at that point was a decent cuppa and time to think, not a visit to the morgue. Why couldn't these forensic people just send a report? He never had understood the necessity of having to be shown the gruesome evidence in all its glory laid out on a slab. What was he supposed to do with the mental images? Chat about them to his wife over dinner? Although it might make an interesting change to Maria Ratcliffe's usual moaning. Not that he could blame her for getting hacked off. She was a good woman who had had to put up with a lot from him over the years. Ferris had completed a basic exam on both victims. Her initial conclusions were that Baxter, whose identity she had confirmed by discovering his wallet still intact inside his rotting clothes, had still been alive when he was placed in the trunk. She showed the detective the feeble scratch marks that scarred the underside of the lid. I don't think he was alive for long, and I don't think he had much strength left when he made these marks.
There is some considerable damage to the skull. I suspect that he was hit repeatedly with something heavy and hard. He would have died from a combination of those injuries and suffocation. There was a substantial amount of sand in his throat. Now that he is out of the sand and out of an airtight box, he's going to deteriorate rapidly, so I needed to find out as much as I could as soon as I could. I also found something clutched in his hand. She held up a bag containing a small gold earring, shaped like a teardrop. My guess is that it belongs to whoever killed him. Ratcliffe took the bag and examined the earring. It wasn't an uncommon design, nothing special at all. Still, if someone could identify it as belonging to Stella, it might strengthen his thoughts on the case. What about the baby? Anything there? Ferris sighed. Hardened as they both were to the nature of their jobs, kids were always a tough call on everyone. I think he was dead before he was put in the box. It looks like he was stillborn. To be honest, it's difficult to tell. From the skeleton, the size of the skull, and the length of the long bones, it looks like he had congenital problems. We did manage to salvage this, though. She passed him another bag containing several thin strips of material. It was what he was dressed in. Through the clear plastic, Ratcliffe could see a name embroidered on the fabric. Daniel, he said aloud. At least the poor little thing had a name. Anyway, I still have tests to do and should be getting more results in soon. I'll let you know as soon as anything comes in, Ferris said, bristling, as if she was far too busy to indulge in such mawkish sentiments. Ratcliffe was relieved to be outside and breathing air that didn't have the rancid aftertaste of decay. No matter how scrupulously clean Ferris's staff tried to be in there, the whole place still stank of death as far as he was concerned. He was puzzled by the assertion that Baxter had been alive when he had been stashed in the trunk. From what they did know about Stella, she was a tiny little thing. Baxter had been 6 foot tall, so how had such a small woman managed to manhandle someone that size into a great big trunk? His only conclusion was that she must have had help, which meant that someone else had known that the boy was there. His money was on the mother, the dead and therefore perpetually silent Valerie. They had to find Stella, which meant he had a very good excuse to pay Francis's husband, Peter Haynes, another visit. Chapter 6. In Rachel's room, the atmosphere was thick with negativity. Waves of tension were washing across the room, fixing them both into the moment and forcing an uneasy silence. D.S. Ratcliffe had only just left, but his questions glowed neon bright in Charlie's mind, as if displayed on an imaginary autocue. How well did you know Stella? What kind of person is she? Did she ever discuss her relationship with her husband with you? Stella's evidence against him in his trial for Patsy's murder had ensured his conviction. He had spent 10 years in prison because of Stella, the woman who had sworn on the Bible to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but. As if anyone living in the Limes even knew what the truth was. Yes, she had walked into the hallway that day and had been open-mouthed with horror to see him kneeling next to Patsy's body, though she had only seen what she wanted to see. She had assumed that because he held a knife in his hand, he was responsible. Charlie was a lot of things, but he'd never been a killer. In his mind's eye, he could see the wounds even now. Great, savage rents spewing out torrents of blood. If he closed his eyes, it was still there. Red pools of it, blossoming on the tiles like a sea of overblown poppies. Blood and more blood soaking into his clothes, clinging to the knife, puddling around his knees. The acrid, metallic tang of it still haunting his nose. Only one person had witnessed the truth of what happened that day. A 10-year-old kid who had epilepsy. A child who couldn't be believed. A child who, according to her mother, was a fantasist and a drama queen. The child of a woman who had despised Charlie for years. Valerie had described Rachel as a problem child to the police. A problem child with an inappropriate crush on an older man. Valerie had blamed herself, of course, telling them that it was her fault that Rachel followed Charlie around like a lapdog. As a witness, she had told the jury she hadn't realized it was a problem until Rachel was prepared to bend the truth for him and cover up his crime. To think that it had gone so far that her child was prepared to lie for him. Valerie had turned out an Oscar-winning performance as she'd told the 12 good citizens that she saw Rachel's weaknesses as an indictment of her own poor parenting. She had testified that Charlie was a devious and charming man, and she had no doubt he had coerced Rachel into falsely defending him. All Rachel had told them was that Charlie had pulled the knife out, not stuck it in, and that he had found Patsy there in the hall after she had been stabbed. The police had said that she wouldn't she? The child was terrified of Charlie Jones, so of course she would lie. The jury had shaken their heads at the picture Valerie had painted for them, and had looked at her with a mixture of pity and disdain. Perhaps that was where it all really began for Charlie. That single moment when he'd realized that the only person in the world who truly trusted him had been Rachel, a geeky 10-year-old kid. Now the adult Rachel watched Charlie warily. That muscle in his jaw was tensing. A bad sign that meant he was in a place where no one else was invited. It was difficult for Rachel to remember a time when she hadn't felt some form of love for him. An image of Charlie's smile was one of her oldest memories. Charlie had never brushed her off, never told her to go away, never told her to be quiet and stop pestering. Back then, he had been like a big brother, 14 years her senior and awe-inspiringly estimable in her eyes. When Delia was working in the house, Charlie could often be found in the garden, hacking at the undergrowth in a vain attempt to abate its creeping bid for dominance. Then in later years, when he had begun working for Roy and had started to bring the lascivious Patsy with him to the limes, he had always, without fail, spared time to say something nice to Rachel. What a pitiful little kid she must have been, so grateful for such meager crumbs and hero-worshipping the cleaner's boy because he had been kind. Frances had been the one with the real crush, but Charlie either hadn't seen the look she gave him or hadn't noticed the effort she made. Frances had even tried to emulate Patsy, by plastering on makeup and cutting off her skirts, until Valerie had slapped her face and called her a slut. She had backed off then, and had treated Charlie with condescending contempt ever since. His conviction for the murder Rachel knew he hadn't committed had made Valerie's day. Rachel had been the first one into the hall the day Patsy died. She had raced away from Stella, running up the drive and into the house, panting for breath, cheeks rosy from the chill winter air. The hall had been strangely silent, as if time was holding its breath as she had hung her scarf and coat on the hall stand. Only when she had turned towards the kitchen had her mouth sagged open and her feet turned to lead. Patsy had been lying on the floor in a crumpled, bloody heap, a blood-streaked bubble of spit popping on her lipstick-slicked mouth as the life ebbed out of her. Rachel had been transfixed, rooted to the spot. When Charlie had strolled into the hall from the kitchen, immediately issuing a guttural, almost primeval cry at the sight of his broken wife, he had thrown himself down onto the floor, instinctively pulling the knife from her chest, staring in horror as a pool of blood crept silently, still warm, towards his knees. Though she could picture it vividly, Rachel couldn't remember how many minutes the old grandfather clock had marked before Stella walked through the door and something other than death had begun to happen. It had felt like an eon. Charlie maintained that he had walked into the back of the house, having come from the park, using the small gate that gave the residents of the Limes private access. However, there were no witnesses. The prosecution postulated that Charlie could have been in the house for any amount of time. No one else was in, so no one could corroborate his story. No one except Rachel. But her evidence was inadmissible and at best purely circumstantial. 10-year-old children were not reliable witnesses. Rachel knew Charlie hadn't stabbed Patsy. She had heard that cry. It echoed in her memory like the sound of nails being dragged slowly down a blackboard. A screeching, penetrating sound that made every fibre of her being sing with pain. Most of all, it was the memory of the hollow devastation in his eyes that assured her of his innocence both then and now. If she told him now, told him the true reason she had walked away from him and Amy, she would see that look again. Not just the shadow of it reflected back at her when she looked into his eyes, but a full-blown recreation of the moment his world had fallen apart for the first time. Patsy, the woman who had brought them together, and the woman who still stood between them. Patsy had been a magical creature, the only person Rachel remembered in color. On the rare occasion she allowed herself to look back at her childhood, everyone else either appeared in black and white, or materialized as a faded, jaded representation of their younger selves. The '70s had been like that, dull and leached of color. But Patsy had been vibrant and alive, like a bird of paradise among a flock of lesser creatures. When Patsy was in a room, she'd had the effect of magnifying everyone else's mundanity. Stella had become smaller and dowdier. Valerie became more pinched and bitter, and even more like an indignant bird of prey than had been usual. Frances's arrogance became whiningly petulant, and Roy had puffed himself up like the peacock he pretended to be. Rachel had felt even more insignificant in Patsy's presence, like a drab cuckoo chick in a borrowed nest. Only Charlie hadn't changed. Charlie never changed. Rachel's thoughts were still consumed with the memory of Patsy lying on the hall floor like roadkill, when Charlie finally broke the silence.
So here we are, pulled together again by your damn family. Like always, eh? And you haven't even asked me about your daughter. Remember her? Amy, in case you've forgotten. For what it's worth, she thinks you're dead. I never had the art to put her straight and tell her she wasn't wanted and you walked away towards the money. Her life's been hard enough without having to know her mother is a bitch. I guess you're just like the rest of them. She tried to speak, but the prickling had started in her head again, making her brain feel like an overshaken coke. Oh, that's it. Have another fit. Opt out again, why don't you? It's what you do best. The venom in his words was pulsing through her like liquid fire. She deserved every ounce of it. She would take it and take it again rather than tell him the truth. He was hurt enough.
I'm sorry, I can't help it, I'm so sorry, she mumbled, already slurring.
When the seizure had abated, and Rachel lay once again in a deep sleep, Charlie rifled through her bag, found her medication, and saw that the day's dose had been taken. He looked in her purse and found a card with the name and contact number of her neurologist and made the call, all the while feeling like an utter bastard for losing it with her. Mr. Parnell, consultant neurologist and Rachel's doctor for the past 19 years, was deeply concerned that her epilepsy had intensified so dramatically. He needed to see her. Soon. Could Charlie bring her back to London as soon as possible? Charlie didn't have a choice. There wasn't anyone else who could take her, and he hardly had a solid reputation for dealing with wifely welfare. Besides, everyone was better off if she went back to London, especially Amy. Of all the things that Rachel had brought back with her, memories, regrets, hurt, confusion, the threat to Amy was the worst of them. If she found out that her mother was alive, she would never forgive him or her grandmother. Christ, he'd spent years taking her to a bloody graveyard once a year to put flowers on some complete stranger's grave just to maintain the lie that Rachel had died. Thank God for common names. He should never have allowed the lie to stand, but his mother had convinced him it was for the best. He'd been so angry and so hurt by Rachel leaving, he'd gone along with it. Like an idiot, like a sad and stupid man. He looked down at the sleeping woman, unsure of how he felt now. Guilty, mostly. He had bullied her and caused the fit. But angry, too, still angry. Still confused. Still hurt. Chapter 7. By the time Rachel woke up, groggy and hungover from the overactive neurotransmissions that were determined to destabilize her brain, Charlie had packed her bag, paid her bill, and was waiting, keys in hand, to drive her back to London. She couldn't have looked more relieved if she'd tried. He was relieved too, but her eagerness to leave stung a little. Damn his bloody head. His thoughts were making no sense. The drive to London was silent and strained. Charlie didn't say much, and Rachel spent the journey with her head resting against the window, eyes closed against the overhead lights that blurred and streaked across the evening sky as they sped past. Charlie let her rest, figuring it was better just to keep his thoughts to himself. He didn't want to trigger off another fit, not in the van, and she'd made it clear she wasn't willing to talk about the past. He had debated phoning his mother to tell her he wasn't going to be calling round that night, but two things stopped him. If Delia knew he was with Rachel, she would probably blow a gasket, and the last thing he wanted to have to deal with was his mother having a stroke on top of everything else. Besides, at 52 years of age, it was hardly necessary to call his mother and check in. The second reason was Amy. He just couldn't contemplate having to explain why he'd been such a shit dad and lied to her for her whole life. He'd stayed out before. It needn't be a big deal if he just played it cool. He glanced at Rachel and tried to work out what on earth he was feeling. Any other man would have just walked away and disappeared, but not him. What kind of mug was he? He must be some kind of masochist going back for more. She was the woman who had just about broken him, but she was also the woman who had given him the most precious thing he had, their daughter. Amy was all grown up and looking far too much like Rachel than was good for his mental health, and still believing that her daddy was her hero. Her daddy felt like a coward and knew he was a liar. Not that anyone had ever stated Rachel's supposed death as a fact. It had been something Amy had assumed. There was a vague memory of her asking Delia about it. Amy would have been about 5, had just started school, and she had asked outright if her mummy was dead. Some snotty-nosed kid in her class had said that if she didn't have a mum, it must be because her mum had died. Delia had heard these innocent words and had looked at him, raising her eyebrows as if that unknown kid had presented them with the perfect solution. Then she had soberly lied and told Amy that, yes, her mummy was dead.
Charlie had never had the guts to disabuse her of the notion. His mother had been right, it had been an easy solution at the time. Even though he'd had to search the county cemetery records to find a grave with the same bloody name when Amy had asked at age 10 if she could take flowers for her mother. It had been excruciating, standing by the grave of some other R. Jones, and watching his little girl put flowers there and tell her mummy what had happened at school that week. He'd felt like the worst scumbag on earth. That was the trouble with lies. They always came back and bit you in the arse eventually. He knew for a fact that over the years Amy had excused his lack of meaningful relationships, his need for solitude, and his moody silences as chronic grief. That was Amy. She could always take something dark and weave it into a bright, shiny ideal just by deciding it was the way things should be. Charlie wished he found it so easy to put such a spin on life. The romantic fantasy that Amy had manifested had satisfied her enough that she hadn't pressed Charlie for details about Rachel. She didn't want to cause him pain. That was his girl. If only she knew, he thought, his face contorting into a wry grimace. Charlie had never had the guts to shatter Amy's illusions about him. An act of cowardice that he was only just beginning to realize had been a big, no, a huge mistake. There had been other women over the years. He wasn't a monk. He had never taken any of them home, didn't want Amy to meet them, and didn't want them involved with her. So all he had managed was to establish a few brief liaisons that had fizzled out quicker than a damp match. He could honestly say that overall it didn't bother him. It wasn't as if his track record with women would stand up to much scrutiny. Something of the kiss of death had followed him where partners were concerned. Not that Rachel was dead. Far from it. Though there had been times over the years that he'd wished she were. How much simpler it would have been just to grieve her loss in the same way he had grieved Patsy, but from behind the bars of a different kind of prison. Then again, his relationship with Patsy had been much simpler. She had been another one, a woman who couldn't take him as he was, but at least Patsy hadn't felt the need to save him from himself like most women did. Why did they always have a desire to save him when the only thing he'd ever needed saving from was them? Patsy had wanted many things, money mostly. It had taken her death for him to realize that she'd never wanted him at all. Rachel was the only one who had ever accepted him unchanged, or so he'd thought at the time. That was why hers had been the biggest betrayal of them all. He almost laughed aloud, stopping himself before he disturbed Rachel. Any chance that anyone had of saving him was so far in the past they'd need a TARDIS to get to it. Perhaps what those women had always said would prove to be true after all. He would die a lonely old man. If Amy ever found out about Rachel, he was certain of it. Rachel pretended to sleep, trying desperately to relax so that she would look more convincing to Charlie. Anything to avoid having to talk to him. All she wanted to do was to get back to the flat, Lila's flat. Then she could shut the past out again and go back to the half-life where she had hidden safely for years. An impossible feat now that the biggest part of her past was sitting right next to her, about to invade the only sanctuary she had. What would he make of her existence? Maybe he would be shocked to see the way she lived. Just a wistful ghost haunting another woman's life. Nothing in the flat had been changed since the day Lila had died. Not a thing. Even the dust just recirculated and settled back exactly where it had come from. Lila's clothes still hung in the wardrobe. Her perfume still sat on the dressing table. Her rings remained on the mantelpiece, all as if she had just stepped out of the room. The furniture was exactly as Lila had placed it, still hiding the bald spots on the rugs and covering the stains. Rachel had preserved it all. Like a more sanitary Miss Havisham, she had conserved Lila's existence in an eternal tableau of fond memories. There was no bitterness in her desire to maintain Lila's home intact, just a need to hang on to something old, familiar and warm. Lila's flat was a home in the way that the Limes never had been, or could have been. Lila had been happy in her London flat, away from her dysfunctional family and all that had come with it. Rachel tried relentlessly to preserve that happiness, constantly hoping that the essence of it would magically transfer itself to her one day. The flat was her bolt hole, her sanity. To someone else it would look precisely the opposite. Hard evidence of her instability, proof of her inability to cope with real life. Would anybody else understand that if you could force time to stand still and preserve a perfect moment of tranquility, that you could step in and out of that place at will? Lila, or strictly speaking Lillian, Porter, had been the polar opposite of her brother. From what little she'd been told about her father, Rachel had deduced that where William had been dull, Lila had been a bright beacon of life. Where he had been mean-spirited, she had been generous to a fault. Where William had resented, Lila had embraced. In Lila's company, everyone felt alive. Even Valerie had grudgingly liked her until Lila had died and had left everything to Rachel. After that, Valerie hadn't liked anyone much. Frances had needled Rachel to sell the flat. It was London real estate worth a small fortune, life-changing in the right hands. Valerie hadn't thought that Rachel's were remotely the right hands. Rachel had measured wealth differently and had hung on to the flat even though her decision had been one of the issues that had permanently damaged the family ties. The other issue she still couldn't and wouldn't talk about. Ever. Chapter 8. Delia tried Charlie's mobile number and listened to the dull, uninspiring voice on the message service for the umpteenth time. There was no point in leaving yet another message. He hadn't bothered to pick up the last three. Why the bloody hell did people bother having mobile phones if they were always going to leave the bloody thing switched off? In frustration, she slammed her own phone hard on the table, dislodging the battery cover in the process and sending it skipping over the tabletop and onto the floor. "Sod it," she hissed, bending to retrieve it and groaning at the stiffness in her back. She couldn't be bothered to fiddle with it to reattach it to the body of the phone, damn thing. A horrible sensation was unfurling in her gut, an instinct that something was about to go horribly wrong. Charlie was incommunicado and Rachel Bloody Porter was back on the scene. Adding two and two together, she was coming up with nothing other than four, no matter how hard she tried to make it five. If she was right and he was with Rachel, they might well have another dead body on their hands by the time she caught up with him and throttled him for his foolishness. She was too old for all of this, and so was Charlie. He was a bloody idiot where that girl was concerned. Always had been, always would be. Delia just had to hope that Rachel wasn't as big an idiot. If she was, then God help them all. By the time Ratcliffe and Angie reached the hospital that evening, having been told that Frances had been woken, she had lost consciousness again. According to her doctor, she hadn't said anything of note during the short time that she had been lucid. Ratcliffe's only conversation had been with Peter Haynes, Frances's rather urbane yet supercilious husband, whose main concern remained the worry that his good name was being linked with something as tawdry as murder. Haynes was adamant that he didn't know where Stella had gone, but had reluctantly agreed to supply a photo of her, though he couldn't guarantee a recent one. He had only conceded to their request because Ratcliffe told him that his wife's purge of the limes had been so meticulous that they had failed to turn up even the remotest clue as to Stella's whereabouts, or her intentions. Even with a photograph and the help of the press, they would be clutching at straws. If a person as nondescript as Stella wanted to disappear, it wasn't particularly difficult to make a thorough job of it. Thwarted by Frances's insentient state, Ratcliffe called it a day and sent Angie home. God knows they all needed a decent night's sleep. This case was getting harder by the minute, and he wanted to face it head-on and fresh in the morning. He'd switched his phone to silent earlier, as per hospital policy, and hadn't thought to check it until he got into his car. He assumed that the message he'd received when it had vibrated in his pocket was from his wife, nagging to know when he would be home. It wasn't. It was from Charlie Jones, informing him that he'd had to take Rachel back to London to see her doctor. As a man, Ratcliffe saw that as a very good idea. The woman was apt to flake out all over the place in his experience, so some medical attention would be a fine thing. As a copper, he saw it as yet more buggeration. He hadn't quite finished with Miss Porter. Having her back in London was going to be an almighty pain in his arse, as if he didn't have enough of those already. Surprisingly, there was a parking space right outside the flat. Instinctively, Charlie reversed in and switched off the engine, only afterwards thinking that he should just drop her and drive away. Just the same as all those times long ago when he stood on this very pavement, looking up at her windows with his courage failing and forcing him to leave things well alone. He had always driven away. "Are you going to come in?" she asked, the tremor in her voice informing him that she was fervently hoping that he wouldn't. Out of stubbornness, he didn't even bother to reply, just got out of the van and followed her up the steps into the building. Inside the flat, he remained silent as the wraith of Lila Porter wrapped itself around him like a stale smell. The past felt almost tangible, and he had the sensation that he was being ripped backwards through time. That nothing had materially changed in the place was weird. That Rachel had never bothered to change it was stranger still. In resistance to his reaction, he tried to put a positive spin on it and thought of Amy. How she would love this place. She would see it as a giant dressing-up box where she could pretend she was someone else entirely. She had always told him that her ultimate fantasy would be to travel back in time. It seemed that her mother had achieved it. Rachel hovered in the kitchen doorway, showing her reluctance to allow him further into her domain. "I can do coffee if you don't mind it black." Charlie glanced around again, glimpsing her existence, finding it wanting and dusty and faded.
"Okay."
He followed her into the kitchen and sat at the table under the window, keeping her in his line of sight but maintaining a safe distance while he watched her fumble with a kettle.
"So what do you do with yourself, then? Are you working?"
he asked, as if they were old acquaintances who had just bumped into each other. He felt as banal as the question had sounded. She poured water in the cups and shook her head.
"No." "What do you do with yourself, then?"
he pressed as she put the cups onto saucers and placed the whole paraphernalia on a tray, just to bring it the few yards to the table. Just like her mother would have done, anything to keep up appearances. She put the tray down, immediately silencing the rattling china that had been so effectively serenading her anxiety.
"I read a lot. Walk. Watch the world go by. Time passes. I don't notice it much."
He picked up his cup, its dainty fragility looking incongruous in his calloused hand. It almost made him smile.
"I half expected to find Stella here."
Rachel hovered, seemingly reluctant to pick up her own cup. He noticed that her hands were still trembling. She gave a wry smile and shook her head.
"She would never come here. Lila scared her. She had too much life for Stella."
That a woman long dead yet still so tangibly present had the ability to dismay the living in such an assiduous way scared him a little too.
"You know, I said that Amy thinks you're dead. She thinks our relationship is sad and romantic and that I'm tortured by unrequited love and grief." He laughed, the sound of it full of scorn. "I've never had the heart to put her straight. And neither should you. Whatever happens, she needs to be kept out of this."
"I suppose it's better for her to think that she was left by someone who didn't choose to go," she said quietly. "But it's going to be hard to stop her reading papers or watching the news. I can't be responsible for that, but she'll never find out from me." Charlie couldn't help it. The bitterness of what Rachel had done had been burning a hole in his gut for years. That she could talk to him so calmly about it just felt like an insult heaped upon injury.
"Better than knowing that your own mother dumped you without a word, yeah, I'd say so. Anything would be better than that,"
he said with potent bitterness, because the truth of her words illustrated a threat that neither of them could control. Lila's kitchen clock ticked loudly, marking the moments that the ugliness of it all hung in the air between them.
"Better than knowing why," she said finally.
He gripped the cup, almost crushing it in an effort not to hurl it at the wall and watch the jagged shards flail her as they fell.
"What about me? I'm not a little girl who needs to be protected from life's shit, Rachel," he hissed,
watching her wince at the suppressed violence of his contained rage and not caring. "Don't you think I deserve to know why?"
"I didn't love you. I didn't want her. I made a mistake."
Even though she closed her eyes when she said it, unable to look him in the eyes, her words sliced at him like a razor, sharp and sure. The extent of the damage would be delayed by the swiftness of the cut, but he would feel it and it would hit bone. He stood, moved towards her slowly, every step an exercise in measured control. He felt drunk, surreal, and incapable of coherent thought. Chapter 9. Peter Haynes stared down at the unconscious form of his wife and wondered if he loved her. Wondered if anyone could truly love a woman like Frances. She was admirable in many ways, cultured, elegant, and formidable. Qualities quite desirable in a partner, but traits that could hardly be termed as lovable. This was the first time he had ever observed her in a state of relaxation, albeit enforced. She looked different, not soft, just less determined than she normally did. It was a strange experience to see a woman you had shared a bed with, shared a life with, transformed into a stranger because of a bump on the head. Quite disturbing, really. Before this, he had always felt proud of her as a wife. She represented him well, even though she could be a little strenuous in her opinions at times, even though her proprietary efficiency was a little forced. She was a good wife, faithful but passionless. Her emotions ran cold and set like stone, only ever emerging as grit-toothed soundbites and only then when necessary to keep up appearances. Children might have helped. However, they had never come along, and if he were honest, he wouldn't have known what to do if they had. He wasn't a man able to tolerate mess and chaos, so maybe it had been for the best. He had no memory of being a child, couldn't relate to what it was like at all. Even in his mother's house, proudly populated with pictures of decreasingly younger versions of himself, he couldn't make the connection. Just felt slightly embarrassed by the tight-lipped, two-dimensional boy that he saw staring back at him from the photographs. Sometimes he was sure that he'd been born old. Despite all that, the one thing he had never, ever anticipated was the prospect of being associated with scandal. Part of the reason that he had chosen Frances for a wife was because her background was good. Her family were a little odd, but of good pedigree, or so he had been led to believe. Never would he have contemplated that they could be capable of the level of depravity that was splashed all over the newspapers. It had come as a shock. In some respects, his other recent discovery had been a greater shock. When Valerie had died, both he and Frances had been relieved. Not only were they free of an unlikable burden, they also stood to inherit a share of the lines. Initially, he had held out hope that Valerie had made a will, cutting out Rachel and favoring Frances above Stella. Typically, she had not. He had assumed that the process of probate would be lengthy but at least straightforward. He'd been wrong. A complication had emerged already. Not only had Valerie not left a will, neither had William, and to top that, there was no evidence that William Porter was actually dead. When Peter had heard from the solicitor that no death certificate was in evidence, he had been incredulous until he had discovered that there was no grave either. No funeral had taken place, no notice had been in the papers. William Porter had simply disappeared into the ether. The only will that had ever decreed ownership of the house was that made by Stella's birth mother. Technically, William still owned the property. For Peter, it was a nightmare situation. One that was costing him £85 an hour every time their solicitor even thought about resolving it. If just one of the bodies found had been William, it would have been far more simple. Distasteful, but simple. Now that he thought about it, the whole thing had been a sham. In selecting him as a husband, Frances had achieved respectability and had managed to disguise herself and her family so that they couldn't be recognized for what they were. He'd been duped. All his assumptions now proved wrong. Stella, the single most ineffectual example of the human condition he'd ever encountered, had been someone to be pitied. Valerie, with all her apparent pride in Frances, had been nothing but guise and guile, all designed to ensnare him and link him to a family of felons and sycophants. As for Rachel, he'd been fortunate enough to never have met her. From what he'd heard, it had been a lucky escape. He couldn't even bear to look at Frances lying there seeming so peaceful and oblivious. She had nothing worse than a head wound while his whole life had been torn apart by her lies. In a fit of pique and disgust, he took the flowers he had bought for her and ran them into the waste bin. He was a decent man, a good man, honourable and upright. He hadn't been equipped for this deceit. Without a backward glance at his wife, he stalked from the ward. Amy was well and truly pissed off. Sent home from her nurse training placement early, she had caught a train home and had been desperately trying to phone her dad since. Only he wasn't answering his phone, and now she would have to catch a bus from the station. She hated buses, especially late buses. They were full of drunks, gobshites, and people with hygiene problems. Some had passengers that combined all three traits. They were the ones who always wanted to sit next to Amy. She had never come home to an empty house, had never been turned down when she had asked for a lift, had never opened the fridge and found it empty of food. Dad was always there, always had been. And now he wasn't. She was more annoyed with him than she wanted to admit. It was his fault she was now standing at a freezing bus stop next to a person who obviously had failed to see the relevance of the I in iTunes. Tinny music was leaking from his earphones and intruding into her already abrasive mood. Where the fuck was her dad? They needed to talk. About what was in the papers. About why he was in the papers. She had been in the office writing up patient notes before handover, when the other student, that supercilious wanker Nick Gribble, had slapped a newspaper down on the desk. Everyone had looked up as he'd said, "Never told us your dad was a criminal, Amy." Mortification hadn't been the word for it. She'd told him to fuck off and had got a bollocking from his supervisor and sent home. The prospect of bouncing off the walls in the nurse's home hadn't appealed, so she'd come home, and no one was going to be there. What made her most angry was the fact that if something like a bank had gone out of business and money was at stake, the fucking papers wouldn't have even thought about raking something up that happened over 30 years ago. Money always trumped people in a news story. There was a photograph of Charlie taking up half the page, because a woman who'd gone missing, and who had probably killed her husband and kid, had been a witness at her dad's trial. Didn't put a photograph of her in there, did they? How fair was that? Neither he nor Gran had ever talked about why he'd been in prison. She'd always known he had been, ever since her second day at school, when Lee Price, a noxious kid who always had dried snot on his jumper sleeve, had said, "My mum said your dad is a murderer. He chopped your mum into little pieces." She stared at him in disbelief, trying to equate what he had said with her big, strong, lovely dad. She'd been horrified and angry and had yelled, "At least I've got a hanky. I don't want bogies on my clothes." She still felt stupid when she thought about it. Gran had picked her up from school that day and had been shocked to see a bandage on her hand. Lee Price had stabbed her with a pencil over the snot jibe. The story had come out in a tearful torrent, and Gran had told her that it was true that her dad had gone to prison, but that it wasn't true that he'd killed anyone. His first wife had been killed, but not by him. Amy had taken this on her 5-year-old chin because if Gran said it, the it was gospel. She had never since questioned his innocence, even though on occasion, mostly when she was pissed off with him, like now, she had been haunted by the thought that he did seem to have a habit of marrying people who had suffered untimely deaths. After that, Gran wouldn't discuss it, and Amy had been warned on pain of death to ask her father about it. Even so, the story ate at her. The dead first wife became the antagonist in her nightmares, and she'd had no choice but to find out what had happened. When she was 13, she'd gone to the library and had mastered the mysteries of the microfiche machine, and had read the reports of what her father was supposed to have done. It didn't stand up in her mind. The words "frenzied attack" in the same sentence as her father's name were so incongruent, she had laughed. Still did. In her imagination, she had packed the whole thing away in the same box as her mother's death. It was all in the mental filing cabinet labelled "romantic tragedies," along with other things that were too difficult to think about very often. As far as Amy was concerned, the fact that bodies had been found at the lines proved that her dad was innocent beyond doubt. Whoever had been killing people in that house, it hadn't been him. Whoever the killer was, they had more than likely framed him. Simple. At least that's what she believed on good days. That's what she would tell someone if they asked. On not-so-good days, when the world felt full of impending doom, she saw it differently. She was torn then, between what she wanted to believe and what her logical mind suggested to her. The conviction that her father was incapable of being a frenzied murderer was absolute, but the suspicion that he might be capable of great passion, immense rage and deep hurt created a worm of doubt that wriggled in her brain from time to time. She knew for a fact that he'd done anger management courses over the years, yet he'd never once lost it with her. All she could base her darker thoughts on were the facts that her father loved her with a devotion that bordered on obsession, and he still loved her mother. If Gran didn't stay with him, he would have locked his child in the house for life just so he could keep her safe. She wouldn't just be wrapped in cotton wool, she would be buried in it. He never had curbed her freedom, but she could tell he wanted to. Only the voice of reason stopped him taking her to a desert island where she would be safe forever. She knew he still loved her mother because he never talked about her, and if anyone asked him, his face would cloud with hurt so intensely that no one dared ask him again. That couldn't be anything else but love, could it? If he had loved the first wife as much, would he have killed her rather than lose her to someone else? Amy knew for a fact that he would kill anyone who threatened her safety. He had said so often enough. A few years before, she had shared her worries with her best friend Kaylee. Kaylee had said that the only way to find out if he had killed the first wife was to ask her via spirit. They had hidden themselves in Gran's bedroom and made a Ouija board out of Scrabble tiles, and had invoked the spirit of Patsy. Gran's room had been a good choice of venue. After all, how scary could anything be if it was experienced on a bed of quilted pink satin surrounded by kitten ornaments? Bloody terrifying, as it turned out. They had scared each other shitless. Kaylee had led the proceedings. Her mother owned a deck of tarot cards, and she was familiar with the ritual of such things, having been witness to many a prediction of handsome strangers and sudden windfalls. Kaylee had laid the letters out in a circle, and had written yes and no on two pieces of paper. On a third, she had written goodbye. She placed them in the circle. In the middle, she put a glass tumbler. They had debated the glass. It had a picture of Blackpool Tower on it, and didn't seem serious enough object to use in the circumstances. But it was all they had to hand, and neither of them thought that any restless spirit would be too concerned about a bit of kitsch. Kaylee had said that any spirit manifesting in Delia's bedroom would have to be oblivious to Tat, otherwise they wouldn't bother coming at all. Amy had laughed with her, but had felt mildly offended all the same. They had both said the Lord's Prayer, just in case, before each putting a tentative digit on the upturned glass. "Is anybody there?"
Kaylee had asked, sounding like Boris Karloff in a bad horror film. Amy had nearly fainted when the glass started to move. She'd pulled her finger away, accusing Kaylee of pushing it, which she strenuously denied, saying, "If you're not going to take this seriously, I'm going home." There had been pouting and umbrage taken. Amy had reassured her that she was deadly serious, and they had tried again, watching as the glass propelled itself under their fingers. The first few words it spelt out were nonsense, not even real words. Only when Kaylee asked for Patsy to communicate with them did anything significant happen. "Are you Patsy?" Kaylee asked the air. Amy had shuddered as the glass moved towards the slip of paper bearing the word yes. "Were you murdered?" was the next question. Again, the glass moved to yes. Kaylee had stared at Amy, eyes wide. "Who murdered you?" Amy had been barely able to breathe as the glass had moved around the circle in undecided moves, finally spelling out the words, "Not him." "See?" Kaylee had said, pleased with herself. Scared and unconvinced, Amy had asked the question again, but nothing happened. The glass hesitated and quivered under their fingers. "Did my father kill you?" she demanded, desperate for a reiteration that it wasn't him. The glass moved again, sweeping around the circle again and again in dramatic arcs, then stopping abruptly in front of the slip of paper which said, "Goodbye." Unnerved by the experience, they had scooped the letters back into their little bag and shoved them back in the Scrabble box. They screwed up the notes Kaylee had written and threw them into the bin. Kaylee was convinced that Amy had conclusive proof that Charlie was not a murderer. Amy wanted to believe it, but wasn't sure. Her logical mind refused to allow her to accept that they had just communicated with a dead woman. But what else could it have been? "What's up? You scared?" Kaylee had asked. "No," she'd lied. "I was just wondering if we could do it again, see if we can talk to my mum." They had agreed to try again the next time they had Gran's house to themselves, probably Tuesday when Delia would be out at bingo again. They did, but absolutely nothing had happened at all. The glass hadn't even attempted to move. Kaylee had explained that it was because Rachel's spirit was at rest. She had passed peacefully and wasn't earthbound like Patsy. Delia had put an end to any further forays into the paranormal. She had found the screwed-up words in her bedroom bin and had instantly worked out what they had been up to. Her attitude towards dabbling with the unknown had been expressed with enough fear and anger to dissuade Amy from trying it again for a very long time, especially when she had insisted that she couldn't sleep soundly in that room afterwards. Amy would never tell Delia whose spirit they had been trying to talk to, and suspected that her gran's insistence that the bedroom was tainted by their activities was just an excuse to get Charlie to redecorate the other, larger room and move her things in there. Delia had even gone so far as to burn the Scrabble game, just in case it was tainted too. Her gran could be strange sometimes. Amy hadn't kept in touch with Kaylee, not since they had left school and gone their separate ways. She missed her. There was no one else she could be as open with, or who knew so many of her secrets. However, given her experience with Nick Gribble, maybe that was a good thing. The less people knew about her, the better. The bus finally arrived and she climbed aboard behind the iTunes idiot and found a seat at the back. She tried her dad's number again just to let him know she was on her way home. The call went straight to voicemail. When she finally made it home, she found the house quiet, dark and empty. Her first task was to turn on all the downstairs lights, then switch on the TV and crank up the heating, if only to drive the shadows and dark thoughts away. She had half hoped to find a note from her father explaining where he was, but he hadn't been expecting her home until the weekend. It was an irrational desire on her part, yet she was disappointed. "You are not the center of the universe, Amy," she said, speaking out loud as if the sound of the words would have a greater chance of admonishing her selfishness than if she'd merely thought them. For one lonely moment she thought about ringing Gran, but would have to explain why she'd been sent home in disgrace. It wasn't worth the hassle. Instead, she wandered out into the kitchen and began to rummage in the cupboards for something to eat. She found a pot noodle lurking at the back of the cupboard, but rejected it on the grounds that, appealing as it was in principle, it would taste of reconstituted cardboard. They always did. Eventually, she settled for a microwave pizza. She picked at it, nibbling at bits of the topping as she watched TV mindlessly, trying to decide whether to have a bath or ring round to see if anyone wanted company. In the end, she decided to work on an essay, a case study on one of the patients at Tynings, the elderly care unit where she had her placement.
Bill had been the wrong patient to choose, in a way. She couldn't examine his past, as nobody knew about it. He had been a street drinker until the police sectioned him and he was admitted to the unit. Then he had been diagnosed with Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, an alcohol-induced dementia. Because it was a rare diagnosis, he had seemed like an interesting case to study at the time. Now that she had to produce 15,000 words on the man, it was her worst choice ever. Bill wasn't even a pleasant character. He was dirty, rude, and he gave her the creeps. But it was too late to change now. The essay was due in a week, and she would just have to make the best of it. The doorbell rang, jolting her out of her reverie with the subtlety of a brick. A plump woman with a vaguely familiar face stood on the doorstep.
"Sorry to bother you, love. Is Charlie in?"
"He's not in at the moment. I can get him to ring you when he gets back," she said politely. If your dad was a builder, it wasn't unusual to have neighbours you didn't know banging on the door because they'd locked themselves out and wanted to borrow a ladder, or they had a leak, a blockage, or some emergency they couldn't fix themselves.
"Oh, no, don't worry. I only wanted to drop this off to him, only I thought it might be important."
She reached into her pocket and handed a broken SOS bracelet to Amy.
"I think your mum must have dropped it when she had that fit in the cafe today, poor woman. I hope she's feeling better now. Quite a thing to see when you're having a quiet coffee of a morning and minding your own business," she said with a laugh. "I didn't find it until after they'd gone, or I would have given it to her then. But I remembered seeing a dad's van parked on the drive, so I thought I would drop it off on my way home. It's lucky, really. I wouldn't have had a clue what to do with it if I hadn't recognised your dad. He did a lovely job on my sister's extension. Anyway, I must be off. Hope your mum is better, love," she said as she waddled off down the drive.
"Thanks," Amy said. The word was so quiet it wafted into the night unheard. She shut the door and stared at the bracelet, puzzled. Perhaps the woman had the wrong Charlie Jones. But she couldn't have. She said she'd recognized him. It dawned on her that maybe he did have a girlfriend. One he hadn't told her about. One who had a habit of having fits in public places. Perhaps that was where he was now. In hospital with this sick woman, whoever she was. She pried open the bracelet to get a look at this woman's details. If her dad had met someone, she had a right to know her name, at least. She had to look twice at the tiny piece of paper. The name inside the identity bracelet belonged to Rachel Jones, with the Jones crossed out and Porter scribbled in next to it. But it couldn't be. That was the name of her mother, and her mother was dead. This couldn't be right. The truth didn't dawn. It hit her full pelt like a punch, leaving her reeling from the impact. She felt sick. She threw the bracelet across the hall as if it was a toxic, physical lie. Staring at it, she half hoped it would dematerialize and take herself away from her like it had never existed, but it remained on the bottom stair, tauntingly real. The address had said Bayswater. She shook her head and went back into the lounge. She would prove this wrong. At most, this would be a coincidence. Her family couldn't have lied to her about this. It wasn't possible. They weren't that cruel. She had discovered that the internet was a wonderful thing a long time ago. You could find out pretty much anything if you knew where to look, and 192.com was a good place to start. All you needed was a name and a vague idea of location. Then you could find out someone's phone number, address, and even whether they were registered to vote. Rachel Porter had no phone, but she was on the electoral roll. She did exist. Amy still wasn't quite convinced that this Rachel Porter was the same Rachel who had married her father and died in childbirth like the tragic heroine of her fantasies. There would have to be a death certificate, a record of her mother's demise, and she knew exactly where to look. Her dad had a trunk at the end of his bed where he kept his personal things. If the evidence she needed was anywhere, it would be in there. Dispassionately, she headed for the stairs, fully prepared to break into his privacy without a second thought. Most of what she found consisted of old business accounts, copies of VAT returns and the like. There were drawings and Father's Day cards that she had made for him over the years, all wrapped in the shawl she had used as a baby. Before this, she would have thought how sweet he was to cling on to such things, but at that moment in time she was so angry with him she wanted to tear everything to shreds. At the bottom of the trunk was a tin box, its hasps sealed with a small padlock. She had never picked a lock, wouldn't have had a clue how to do it, and didn't fancy spending hours pissing about with a hair grip and getting nowhere. Neither was she prepared to waste time looking for the key. Her father was a security-conscious man and had spent too long in the company of felons not to be, so wherever the key might be, she would be unlikely to find it easily. Instead, she ran down to the garage, taking the box with her, and broke it open with a pickaxe, the contents exploding all over the concrete floor,
on the third blow. The box was ruined and she couldn't have cared less. She was only interested in the contents. Sure enough, she found her